Good morning and welcome. My name is Richard Tanter from the Nautilus Institute, and it's my pleasure to open this public symposium on Australia and Japan towards a sustainable security. We're going to have comments and welcome both from Professor Inoguchi Takashi and from Professor Peter Hayes. But I'd like to begin, first of all, by the important part of acknowledging the role of the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs, and in particular, the Australia-Japan Foundation, which has made this symposium possible. We're very grateful, and we do hope it makes a contribution to the wider goals of the foundation of increasing understanding between Australia and Japan of their shared interests, their concerns, and the directions in which they may go in the wide issue of security, quite broadly understood. So without further ado, I'll just say one thing, please, for translation, for those of you who don't know, there is simultaneous translation, units are available outside if you don't have them, and I think they're quite straightforward to operate. If there's any questions, please see one of our staff at the back. So without further ado, I'll introduce Professor Inoguchi Takashi of the University of Tokyo, one of Japan's perhaps most distinguished international relations specialists. Professor Takashi, Inoguchi.
Good morning. I'm Takashi Inoguchi. I have been a good friend of Australia, and then I think this Australia-Japan bilateral meeting, governmental and some in the government, all welcome. And then basically, the Australia-Japan was not easy bilateral relations. So you have to do coming to terms after the World War. But then Australia-Japan quite made great initiatives in making the, envisioning the lives of Asia in the 1960s and the 70s. And then now we are entering the phase in which Australia, Japan are cooperate, coordinate more globally, more regionally, coordinating, especially in terms of norm making, rule shaping, with an eye not only at the region, but globally, because the kind of issues that come up to both of us, basically universal, global in nature, common rules. You touch on freedom, democracy, and then some kinds of capitalism, and then that may not be easy, but we have to endeavor to shape the rule making, rule making in the global settings, because whatever we do in the region have huge implication to the global developments. And then this is the agenda of this meeting, that is basically we touch on a lot of economic aspects, trade, investment, and whatever. And then alliance. We have seen the Nikkei reporting that the United States and Australia are planning or thinking or being speculated about setting up a military space in northern part of Australia in relation to the difficulty of Futenma airfield in Japan, etc. And then we have a huge problem of energy and climate, and something has to taken in some initiative must be taken if only because easier to talk, because we have done enormously in the past. So this is the agenda of this meeting. That is something we look forward to discussing and presenting, and then further meetings. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Inoguchi. That's very fine explanation of the range and the rationale of this meeting. I'll now introduce my colleague from Nautilus, the Executive Director of the Nautilus Institute for Security and Sustainability, Professor Peter Hayes.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you for those introductory remarks by Professor Takashi Noguchi. I remember many, many years ago, must be 20 years ago, maybe even longer, he was at the UN University in a very senior role, and we were able to convene a meeting on the North Korea problem, which I think in its day was quite an important step forward. So I was very grateful that he was willing to serve this morning as the co-convener of this meeting. Of course, the world has moved on in the last 20 years, and Australia and Japan have moved in parallel paths down many issues. And are finding increasingly that not just with respect to the traditional security concerns related to having an alliance relationship that they share with the United States and some common insecurities related to, for example, the relationship with China or the shared and very complex issue of the North Korean nuclear breakout, but also that we have to now respond to these what are called somewhat quaintly non-traditional security issues, or perhaps more human security issues, such as viral pandemic replication related to our interdependence and travel and mobility, to issues of urbanization and ecological insecurity. Many of these issues are very different in our two countries, but we also have so much to learn from each other. In the last 4 or 5 years, I was fortunate to be directing the creation of a program on climate change adaptation at RMIT University in Melbourne. And one of the things that I discovered was that so many of the issues that we need to deal with in our major capital cities in Australia have already been conceptualized in advance for us here in Japan. For example, the notion of urban wind corridors and how large buildings affect the ventilation of cities is something that we have done very little work on in Australia in thinking through the heat island effect related to climate change, yet there has been superb and extensive work here in Japan that we were able to draw on and bring into the Australian research community. And there are other innovations that I think are very important to Australia in the theoretical level of, say, ecological security. And I think here of the theory of kogai, or the theory of pollution, that Professor Junui at Tokyo University created back in response to the Minamata disease disaster. This is something that actually I think is a world-class theory that we need to know about all over the world, but especially in Australia. So today we will address a number of apparently separate and disparate issues that in fact are deeply interconnected, and it's really trying to come to terms with that complexity that actually we do share the source, or the problems are common, and many of the solutions need to be shared, both in a bilateral sense, but also in concert and in coordination of our policies at a global and a regional level. So with no further ado, I think we should just go straight into the first session, and I'll hand it back to Richard. Thank you. And thank you again for coming this morning.
Peter, thank you very, very much. So I'll now introduce our first speaker, who is Richard Andrews from the Australian Embassy here in Tokyo, where he's the Minister, Councillor, Political. And he'll give us a broad outline of the relationship between Australia and Japan and some of the concerns that he will outline for us. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's actually a great pleasure for me to be here at the International House of Japan. I spent three very happy years at the International House of Sydney University when I was a university student, which is affiliated with this International House, and indeed I met my wife there, so it's a place which has good associations for me. And I should start by offering regrets from Ambassador Miller, who had hoped to be able to be here today, but unfortunately other official duties have kept him from doing so. His loss is my gain, of course, and it's an honour to be able to address so many distinguished participants, if perhaps a little bit scary for me. It's a good measure of the way things have changed in the Australia-Japan relationship that we should be having so many seminars of this type discussing where we can take the Australia-Japan security relationship in the future. When I was first here on posting in the late 1990s, I often used to go down to the Foreign Ministry and ask them to talk about regional security issues, and I'd get some blank looks, people looking a bit bewildered, and the unspoken message seemed to be, why would we want to talk to Australia about these issues? Indeed, in those days, I often used to think of the relationship between Australia and Japan as a bit like the tennis player Jimmy Connors, who had a very big left arm, which he used for serving, and a very small and weak right arm, which he just used to support his left arm when he was playing his other shots. Everything in those days was about trade and investment, and security relations were the poor cousin. That certainly changed. If I could continue the simile, perhaps the relationship is now a bit more like Bjorn Borg, a bit more balanced. But perhaps like Bjorn Borg, we can say that it's about time that we started to get away from the baseline and come to the net a little bit more often. And indeed, we're starting to see that happen, as indeed was the case during Japan's recent earthquake and tsunami crisis, when at one point I went out to the airport at the US base at Yokota to see, on a very cold March morning, and I have to tell you, the hangars at Yokota are the only buildings I've ever been into which, without the help of air conditioning, are able to be at least 10 degrees colder than the surrounding air outside, to see all three of Australia's operational C-17 aircraft on the tarmac at the same time. One of them had brought in an urban search and rescue team, which had been deployed to Minami Sanriku. And then that plane went and flew more than 500 tons of relief supplies around Japan in the coming week. And two more brought in pumping equipment for use at the Fukushima nuclear power station. Indeed, for both Australia and Japan, that kind of cooperation symbolises why this partnership has routinely come to be referred to as our second most important partnership, security partnership in the region, obviously after that both of us have with the United States. Australia was the only country, other than the United States, which was able to send Air Force planes to participate in the disaster relief effort here in Japan. It's the only country, other than the United States, with which Japan so far has a regular 2+2 meeting of defence and foreign ministers. It's the only country, other than the United States, with which Japan has signed an acquisition and cross-servicing agreement, or ACSA, which, for those of you who are not specialists in this field, means that we are able to provide each other with supplies. We have a legal framework for providing each other with supplies when our forces are cooperating with each other. And we're working towards further agreements, including on the sharing of information, that will enable us to cooperate still more closely. So you can see that this has become a very rich and much more mature security relationship in the sense of traditional security areas. And of course, it's no accident that much of the value we derive from this relationship comes from the fact that both Australia and Japan are allies of the United States. So if I could run the risk of mixing my metaphors, 10 years ago, trying to promote the Australia-Japan security relationship here in Tokyo felt a bit like trying to make water run uphill. Whereas now, a change in the landscape has occurred, and it's more a matter of channeling where the river goes as it flows downhill and gains volume along the way. Obviously, there are some clear reasons for this change in the landscape. As all of us know, every country in the world, let alone in this region, is focused on the security implications of the speed with which the very populous emerging economies are growing and the consequent changing strategic realities. And these changes are particularly intense within our own region, with not only China and India, but others such as Vietnam and Indonesia rapidly acquiring increasing weight and importance. So against this background, it's vital that countries with a strong coincidence of interest, such as Australia and Japan, work closely together to make sense of the new environment and ensure that it's shaped in a way that allows all countries of the region to pursue their right to develop peacefully. That's why the security relationship needs to and does include not only issues of concrete military cooperation, but also of regional architecture. And that topic's particularly relevant, of course, this week when we're waiting for the first East Asia summit, in which both the United States and Russia will also participate. And that itself is an outcome which Australia and Japan have worked closely together to try to achieve. But the change in landscape is also a reason why it's vital to have the kind of discussion that I expect we're going to have here today, taking us outside some of the traditional areas of security to examine issues of sustainability. And those issues are particularly vital for a country like Australia, which is a major exporter of energy, and a country like Japan, which is a major importer of energy. Cooperation such as our countries enjoy is only possible when we instinctively understand how our interests coincide, and nuclear security is one such area where over many years we have built trust and experience working together. And in the lead up to the May 2010 NPT review conference, as many people will know, we convened together the International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, which was headed by our former foreign ministers Gareth Evans and Yoriko Kawaguchi. And since that cooperation and that conference, we have established the Non-Proliferation and Disarmament Initiative, which takes forward the outcomes of the conference. So Australia and Japan are co-chairing a group with countries as diverse as Germany, the United Arab Emirates, and Mexico to lead multilateral efforts towards a world without nuclear weapons. And another offshoot of that effort has been the Asia-Pacific Leaders Network, which has been meeting here in Tokyo this week in a sort of interlocking way with the Nautilus Institute's own efforts. Australia and Japan are natural partners, and we share deep bilateral economic, political, strategic, and cultural links built by far-sighted leaders over more than a century. Foreign Minister Rudd said just last week during the Australia-Japan conference in Brisbane, "Ours is not a marriage of convenience, but a set of deep bonds underpinned by shared values and common interests." Gatherings such as the one we're at today have a very important role to play in the building of that trust and in providing ideas for further development of the relationship. And I thank the organisers for putting it together, and I look forward to a very active and interesting discussion this morning.
Richard, thank you very much for that. I'm very pleased to hear that expression of the range of common interests and concerns and the developments, particularly in recent years, that have made have brought the countries so much closer, both socially and, I think, politically and in security terms. Before I introduce the first panel, I'd just like to make two or three announcements. Firstly, we have a strict finishing time in this room, which means we must leave at 12 p.m. We have decided to forego questions from the audience here in this room simply to allow time for speakers, but all of the speakers have kindly agreed to remain behind in the lobby downstairs to answer questions. And though I'm sure that the discussion can continue actively there. The second thing I unfortunately have to announce is that two of our speakers have not been able to join us because of illness. Firstly, Professor Richard Lever from Flinders University has actually a very serious condition, and he was not able to fly. And so we will miss him very much. And we've just been informed this morning that Dr. Ida Tetsunari from the Institute for Sustainable Energy Policies is also unable to join us. We're not able to replace Richard. Those of you who know him, he's something of a living national treasure in Australia and inimitable in many respects. And we can't replace Dr. Ida either, but we do have my colleague Peter Hayes, who doesn't look like him, but has very rapidly brought together a presentation on the same on that same set of issues. We'll be breaking for tea at 10:25. I'll just explain that each speaker has 10 minutes, and the timing, by which will be enforced by my colleague Joan Diamond at the back, will be draconian. And this is simply so that we can get through the range of issues that we do want to address. So can I ask each of the four speakers in the first panel, Mr. Sukugawa, Dr. Takase, Peter Hayes and Colin Hazeltine, I think we can just come up individually, I think it's fine. So I'll start then just with introducing the first panel. The session is on climate change, energy interdependence and the agenda for sustainable security after Fukushima. We originally planned this workshop to occur in Tokyo in June, and clearly once the appalling events at Fukushima began, it was clear that it was not appropriate to do so. That meant the work was postponed, but also deepened because a number of issues became much clearer to us, in particular those issues related to energy, those related to the wider cooperation between Australia and Japan on climate change became much more clear, and particularly with Australia as a major exporter of uranium to Japan and to other countries, as well as the wider concern about nuclear energy and its relationship to climate change issues. So we're very fortunate today to have four experts and people who have a great deal to say and know Australia quite well in this respect. First person I'd like to introduce is Mr. Paul Sukugawa. Mr. Sukugawa is now with Mitsui Iron Ore Development and Sims Metals, which he's a director. I first met him when he was a vice president of the Mitsui Corporation. He has a wide background in minerals issues, but particularly he knows Australia very well, having worked for, I think, a very long time, particularly in Western Australia, the heart of the Australian mining industry. Without further ado, I'll introduce Mr. Paul Sukugawa. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, that's great. Okay. Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Well, in fact, and kind introduction, Dr. Tantor. In fact, I have been involved in iron ore industry for the entire career. I want to talk this morning about this relation between the two countries from business perspective. Doesn't work. And this? Oh, hang on. Okay, right. Well, Japanese Trading House is kind of very unusual, you might say, from the world business scene, unusual organization, which is called Sogo Shosha. And we have been very successful and active in trading business initially. We were into financing of the project or information gathering, price negotiations, and those things from the standpoint of an agent of buyers. But as the internet has been developed, you see, every customer decided that why do we need to rely on an agent to do the negotiations, things like that. So we decided to move away from trading and more into investment in large joint ventures, especially in Australian mining field. And naturally, as you can see from the past 10 years or 15 years, many consumers like steel companies in Japan, steel companies in China, power suppliers, all these companies have decided to have some a jar of cookies, you might say, that they wanted to have their own equity investment. So they opened their representation offices in Sydney or in Perth and those places, and they started to acquire some bits and pieces of equity in the mining business. But resource investment, as you can see, is not such an easy task. And many of consumers' investment ended up today, you might say, ended up being small scale or into a rather not so competitive part of the business. So I think the importance of the role of this major trading company is even greater today. We're into iron ore business in the Pilbara, which is the northern part of Western Australia, coal in New South Wales and Queensland, oil and gas development, uranium and others. Well, and March 11th happened. And before I plunge into my presentation in this slide, I want to pay high tribute and respect and appreciation to my colleagues and friends in Australia in sending their rescue forces, their special aides into the area immediately after the cataclysm happened. Because of this Fukushima, you can see clearly that power suppliers are trying to reactivate their obsolete coal-fired power stations and oil and gas power stations. It's not an easy task. It takes time. And there are some like coal-fired power plants that were damaged by the earthquake. And it takes more than 2 years to reactivate those plants. You see, you're talking about huge turbine. So it's not an easy task, and it's going to take time. The sustainable supply of these fossil fuel becomes a very, very important business for us. Naturally, there is accompanied problems of this CO2 emission. Right? Well, last week, Australia has passed this CO2 was a carbon tax thing. And well, it cannot be ignored in the medium to long term. But at the moment, we need to tackle the task of how we can have the sustainable power supply in this country. If you take a look at this, it's a comparison between last year and this year of the power demand and where the power comes from. Well, the fossil fuel naturally has risen from, what, that 62% to 70%, and nuclear power plant naturally goes down. And because of that, it does not represent anything that hydroelectric power has been built in this short time or anything like that. It's only a marginal increase there. And if you take a look at this, it's in the fossil fuel, you see, which area has been a big increase here. And, well, coal seems to be staying reasonably about the same percentage because many of Tohoku and TEPCO's old coal-fired power plants have been destroyed, and it's going to take more than 2 years for them to come up again. And oil and gas is seems to be playing an important role here. Unfortunately, I did not have enough time to go into oil and gas. I only went into coal. But if you look at this, it's 69%. It's almost 70%, you see, of coal is coming from Australia. It's a huge number. The second is, well, far below that, and it's in Indonesia. Indonesia is actually the largest supplier of steaming coal to the world, but Australia stays the by far the number one for Japan. And if you take a look at this, this is I'm turning my eyes to nuclear power plants. Currently, it is if you look at here, it's below 20% of what we have. The operation rate is it's below 10 units, and this tendency seems to be going still forward. So, what comes next is a big question. We, from business perspective, we're watching how the government is going to handle this situation. It is a difficult situation, and from our perspective, it is obvious that, well, reactivation of those suspended nuclear power plant in this country seems to be highly. I'm talking about in the general sense, very difficult. I wouldn't say that it is highly unlikely because some of the plants that are undergoing inspections or testings will come up. Well, we'll have to be watching the situation very carefully, how the government handles this difficult time. At the same time, having said that, it is inconceivable that a nuclear power generation itself in the world is going to be shunned. Many countries are looking forward to building new power plants. This is the world view of nuclear power plants. The gray area is the existing units. We have about 440 units, and about 60 units are under construction. And you see, the leader of this new construction is China. We have Russia. We have Republic of Korea and other countries. So just recently, you see, Vietnam and India announced their willingness to go ahead in construction of new nuclear power plants. So there is some, future for this technology to be newly erected and newly operated. So there's another factor that you can see that Russia is seen to terminate its supply of diluted military-grade uranium by 2013 to 2014. That means that the supply is going to diminish. And so I believe that there will be a reasonable level of demand for uranium. This is a pie chart of world production of uranium concentrate. And Australia is only 11% of the world production. But from Japanese perspective, Australia plays a major role in its supply of uranium to Japan, 36%. about the same as Canada. So Australia is playing a very important role there. So my conclusion is that demand of fossil fuel as well as uranium will continue to be very strong. Australia stays to be a very major player in this field, and we have to recognize this importance of mutual relations, especially because of the geographic proximity between the two countries. That's the view from a business perspective. Thank you very much.
Paul, thank you very, very much for that very clear and lucid introduction to perhaps the most basic relationship between Australia and Japan, one which has grown to an extraordinary level in the last 40 years. I'm now going to turn to my colleague in work with Nautilus, Dr. Takase Kae from the Governance Design Laboratory. She is an energy analyst, a very senior energy analyst in Japan. And I should just say, together with our other Nautilus colleagues, in particular David von Hippel, who is, where is David? There. Takase-san, together with Peter Hayes and myself and Scott Bruce and Joan Diamond, produced a rapid reaction report from Nautilus on what happened in Fukushima, which appeared 7 days after the first incident then. And then David von Hippel and Takase Kae wrote a much more substantial inquiry into energy alternatives of Japan following on from that 3 weeks later. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce to you Dr. Takase Kae. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard, for the nice introduction. My name is Kae Takase. I belong to Governance Design Laboratory. It's a very small research institute. And as Richard said, we have done an analysis right after the Fukushima. And this, I will talk about the analysis later, but I will talk in the title, Fukushima and Energy Paradigms in Japan. Well, before Fukushima, energy paradigms in Japan, main paradigms, not for the old people, for the old people, but for the government, was that nuclear to dominate more than 50% of electricity in the near future, like 2030, in the energy basic plan of the government says it should be more than 50% of the energy. But as Sukagawa-san said, there's a after Fukushima there's a problem with restarting. Thank you. I catch cold. There's a problem with restarting from periodical inspection. Nuclear power plants has to stop and go to the periodical inspection after 1 or 3 years of operation. And Japanese power utilities have been problem with restarting. And as you can, as you can see, this is a Fukushima accident. It's decreasing very rapidly after. So the problem is that the question is that how should we do with nuclear power for the future, near future, and for the long future? And well, there's some ways to think in Japan. Well, there's some very green people, including my friends, no restarting. Well, they should stop all the nuclear power. We should stop all the nuclear power in Japan, no restarting. But there's some group of people to say, well, we should restart the plant which we have already built and have some years to operate for the future. There's another group of people that we should restart and add plans that as we planned before. So there's some group of people about the nuclear issue in Japan right now. And it will affect to CO2 emissions, as Kagawa-san said before. There's a if we don't use nuclear power, we should burn fossil fuel in the fossil fuel power plants. So CO2 emissions will increase logically, and there should be some additional cost. In every way that we take, what should be CO2 emission? What should be the cost of these three scenarios would be of our interest. So I made a very symbolic four scenario for the nuclear power until 2020, and this is the point 2011 right now, and it's decreasing. The power plants under operation decrease very much, but after that, there could be four scenarios: no restarting or phase out in the future, but operate the plants that we have. It's kind of, you know, the word mottainai in Japan is that we should use the things that we have. We should not buy new things, but it's a mottainai scenario. And the third one is phase out, but we should operate for 40 years, longer time. The fourth one, I don't think this will happen, but go as planned scenario. So add more nuclear power, and we should rely more on nuclear. There could be four scenarios for the nuclear power. And this is scenario analysis. You might not be interested in this very complicated figure, but it's very nice to, nice coloring, and it's nice to see. So this is very interesting. CO2 emissions of those four scenarios. This no restart scenario will increase the CO2 emission definitely, but this phase out scenario to decrease in the future, but also to pay a lot of effort on renewables and other renewables and those energy saving appliances will emit less CO2 than nuclear scenario, because we don't have Fukushima one anymore. It should be like this if you have Fukushima, but the realistic scenario says that phase out scenario would emit less CO2 than go for nuclear scenario. This is very interesting, and this is the report that David mostly wrote this report, but I helped him to collect data, and this is the calculation done by David mostly. But it says that we have to cover up lost nuclear power plants for at least like 3 to 5 years, because the generation capacity is lost. We have to cover up for that, and this shows the way. A is conventional way with gas power. Since we quickly add the gas power with the not much efficient, but very basic conventional gas power we assume here, and also energy saving and small generation like the 1 kilowatt 1 to 3 kilowatt generation power plants that we set in the house, or the bigger generation plants to set in the apartment and those commercial places, and the wind power and photovoltaics. And this will ended up with the mostly same annual cost of all capacity. This was very interesting. This is very interesting result that it won't be much costly if we go to energy saving and other photovoltaics and wind power scenarios. But I'm sorry to say that this will not increase the uranium import from Australia, but this could be one of the scenarios. So will the scenario realistic? We have to check with what happened after the March 11th. And this is the energy demand decrease we observed in last summer, summer in 2011, and in TEPCO area. TEPCO area, there was 14% decrease in total demand of electricity compared to 2010. And also household saved energy for 12%. I also paid a lot of effort not to turn on the air conditioning, and also didn't use the electricity to my rice cooker in the summertime. I used the gas to and all those effort was done in TEPCO area this summer. And it was very interesting that household could save energy for electricity for 12%. It's a very big amount of electricity decrease. And also, this is my calculation that there's no public statistic for the year 2011, but I estimated the using a lot of data around to see what happened after that March 11th for the solar photovoltaics increase after the disaster, and it's increasing very sharply. And also, there's a good news for the renewables. This is the cost estimate done by the expert of solar PV production process. The solar power can, the cost of the solar power can decrease more than 40% in 2020 and could be almost one third in 2030. And it's so this is the summary. And our scenario analysis indicate that nuclear phase out scenario will emit less CO2 than putting too much power on increasing nuclear power. So cost of deploying more renewables, energy-efficient appliances, distributed generation will not be higher than building new gas power in an urgent manner. And it was proved that Japanese citizens are willing to take action in energy saving, putting rooftop PV, especially after the Fukushima accident. And I'm very number person, so this is the energy paradigm that I can show you in numbers after the Fukushima. Thank you.
Dr. Takase, thank you very much for that. I think what's particularly important is precisely the fact that you are, as you said, a numbers person that can give us some confidence in the conclusions that were then drawn from that. So I am very grateful for that, and it's followed on very well from Paul Sugawa's presentation. As I said, unfortunately, Dr. Ida Tetsunari is not able to join us this morning, but instead, Peter Hayes will speak on that broad question of climate change and energy independence and Australia and Japan. Peter, thank you.
Actually, Dr. Aida emailed me this morning to send his apologies. He's not sick. He was summoned to work on Japan's new energy policy. So he is engaged in his official duties and apologizes profoundly for not being here. He had planned to be here, and I'm a very poor substitute for the extraordinarily energetic Dr. Aida Tetsunari, who many of you know. First, I'd like to begin my remarks by just expressing Nautilus Institute's and my own condolences to the Japanese people and the residents who continue to still suffer from the aftermath of the terrible events of March the 11th. It truly was a global event, and I think everyone felt that they were here even as it happened. So I'll begin my remarks by looking first at the big picture concept of energy security. In Australia, energy security has traditionally been thought of in a very narrow way as to whether we have enough economically recoverable energy resources to power the Australian society and economy. And we, of course, have these immense stocks of fossil fuel and uranium, and if we care to, immense amount of sun hitting a huge land area that then can be captured either through photosynthesis or technological transformation and used should one have to. We have not been driven there very much in the past. Whereas in Japan, the concept has been a much more comprehensive concept, especially in the mid-1990s, a very comprehensive concept related to geographical diversity of supply, the fuel type diversity, and then the technological diversity of the transformation of the primary energy into the useful secondary energy forms was developed. And not only was this set of diversity indices developed here, but the centrality of cultural and social aspects of how the energy is brought to the point of end use was also built very deeply into Japan's energy system. Whereas in Australia, large central organizations simply basically deliver the power for end use, there isn't actually much debate about how it is done or the nature of end use and the community impacts and a role for communities in the decisions related to energy choices. That's beginning to change in Australia, driven in part by the climate change issue. And one of the really, I think, big impacts of Fukushima globally, and this will affect Australia, is the conclusion that disaster response actually doesn't just rest with centralized power stations and large organizations, but that the combination of modular renewables that can be built up very, very quickly in a decentralized fashion using market mechanisms and community mechanisms, combined with long-distance grid integration so you can transport the renewables and overcome the intermittent nature of wind and solar power, combined with a smart grid where the supply and demand is constantly adjusting in response to marginal prices at the point of end use, and combined with super efficiency, that this combination that Kai showed us, even in a 2-year period, could respond as fast, in fact, probably faster, should the central organizations actually provide support as against totally leaving it to decentralized institutions. This was actually something that was new. We discovered it in the course of an absolutely classic civil society response to the disaster. I was sitting in a coastal house on the southern coast of Victoria when Fukushima happened, and I got a phone call, I think, from Richard to say, you need to go on the internet. And very quickly, we were able to contact our colleagues in Tokyo because of the internet over Skype. And we decided that because we had been working with our colleagues here so closely for so many years, that we had a unique set of data on supply and demand of energy where we could assemble an initial report on the implications of this disaster within days. And we managed, working in this network over the internet across time zones in 7 days, to produce a fairly substantial first cut at the energy implications of the tsunami in Fukushima. And then a month later, a much deeper analysis, which the economics of which turned out to be remarkably, it was actually surprising to me that the economics worked out so well for this combination of decentralized and efficiency and smart grid versus fix the old fossil fuel or bring in new fossil fuel and repair nuclear if you can. What wasn't in the graph that Kai showed you was an additional economic factor, which we looked at, but we didn't really calculate out in full. What we discovered there, which is a really important lesson for disaster response, is that if you add in the value of the foregone electricity and the fact that you can actually respond, if you really put your whole social institutional momentum behind it, with this decentralized strategy faster than the centralized plants, because you cannot fix some of those plants within 2 years. It just cannot be done. That the value of electricity at the margin, when you don't have it, is so high that renewables actually will pay for themselves in a very, very short time. The value of a kilowatt hour of electricity, and this is an empirical datum, this is not, you know, academic theorists, from studies that were done in Germany. David, where are you? What was it, about $7 a kilowatt hour, $6.50 a kilowatt hour electric?
Eight.
Very high. Just think of how much you're willing to pay for a flashlight battery and convert that into a kilowatt hour of electricity when you really need a flashlight. You're willing to pay a lot for electric power. Even in rural areas of Colombia, people are willing to pay $1.50 to $2 per kilowatt hour electric if they really need it. And boy, did they need it here in Japan. And this is a lesson that's really important in other places that are disaster vulnerable. We are actually in California now, as a result of Fukushima, starting to think about exactly this issue in response to earthquake vulnerability. And amazingly, in California, such a study has not been done up to this point. In Australia, we were hit by enormous floods in Brisbane. You know, a large part of Brisbane was underwater for some days, including my relative's apartment that was destroyed. And those floods also flooded some of the coal mines that Dr. Sukugawa was referring to, that export enormous amounts of coal. So here we see the climate threat starting to actually intervene rather directly into these transnational energy interdependencies in a very disruptive fashion. And we also find that the grid, the long-distance grids in Australia, are very vulnerable, it turns out, to fire threat Australia is basically one of the most flammable ecological communities on the planet. The whole of the Australian landscape was shaped by fire and continues to be extremely vulnerable to fire. And our gradually, increasingly interconnected grids at the state level, which enable us to ship bulk power, including renewable large-scale wind power these days, is actually highly vulnerable to large-scale bushfires. And we're talking firestorms, we're not talking small bushfires in Australia. And in the same way here in Japan, I think we discovered that the fact that you have two separate grids on different frequencies is a really structural, fundamental obstacle that in the long run will have to be overcome if you're really going to exploit renewables on a large scale. We also discovered out of Fukushima that there was some shared energy security implications on the nuclear side. And from, I think, the Australian perspective, the pivotal choice now for Japan that will affect us globally and regionally, particularly with respect to the Korean Peninsula, but also the whole feasibility of the nuclear fuel cycle and the nuclear renaissance, actually is what happens not so much to the light water reactors, but to the Rakkasho reprocessing plant. I think we all can see that there is a contraction of how much nuclear power will serve in Japan. There's a political struggle going on that relates to the core political economy of the structure of the oligopolistic nature of the nuclear of the electric power industry here. But there is a deeper choice, and in a sense we see the nuclear establishment closing ranks. We'll have less reactors so that we can have Rakkasho, and we can have spent fuel reprocessing, and we can in the future have retrieval of the plutonium and even breeder reactors. And this, I think, has enormous implications for what happens in Korea, for how Australia will relate to the Korean nuclear industry, and what happens with respect to North Korea and how China in turn responds to the North Korean nuclear challenge. So the Japanese choice over this issue actually is driving many other dynamics that are intimately interlinked. And so another Australian possible contribution to thinking about this issue is to bring some of the expertise in Australia on deep borehole drilling and geologic disposal, direct irretrievable disposal of spent fuel in a safe fashion, and to think whether deep borehole disposal is an appropriate strategy for dealing with the spent fuel in Japan, rather than putting it in what is effectively becoming a long-term storage site for the spent fuel at Rakkasho, with a kind of constipated reprocessing system that's not really going to ever work. And I think, in fact, I asked John Carlson last night if we could find out who are the deep borehole experts in Australia so we can start that conversation with our colleagues here. So I'll just conclude with one final note very quickly, which is there was a particularly important contribution during the Fukushima crisis from one individual who now is in government, and that is Dr. Suzuki Tatsuhiro. Dr. Suzuki is the vice chair of the Japan Atomic Energy Commission, and in the immediate aftermath of the crisis, as we started to get calls from Al Jazeera and CNN and all the rest of it, those of us who'd worked in Japan, both here in the United States and around the planet, there was not a lot of information coming out of Japan for obvious reasons. There was a crisis. Everyone understood that. But there was still a need to respond and interpret what was going on. And I have to say that what Dr. Suzuki did, which was to go onto Facebook and simply share the absolute distilled essence of what was happening in real time, made a really global contribution both to our own ability to respond in a meaningful fashion. But I know for a fact that people in the White House were reading Facebook, Dr. Tatsuhiro Suzuki's comments, in order to figure out what the US government should be doing, even though they had people here in Tokyo in the office of the Prime Minister. They were finding out more from Facebook and Dr. Suzuki, where he took his civil society identity with him and played a role in increasing the transparency. So I think that that was another lesson that we Australians can learn about the need for transparency in our energy security decisions. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Peter, thank you very much for that. Particularly appreciated in the circumstances there. Our last speaker in this first panel gives me great pleasure to introduce Colin Hazeltine, who is currently a senior associate with the Nautilus Institute and working with us in Australia. But he is by background a diplomat and has served both as ambassador for Australia in the Republic of Korea, but also as executive director of APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Community. So he brings a very particular practitioner's experience to this, and it's my great pleasure to welcome Colin Hazeltine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've been asked to talk this morning about the security challenges facing Australia and Japan. What Richard didn't mention in my in his introduction was that actually a lot of my career was in China and in Taiwan, and I have a lot of current interests in China. So it may not be surprising that I'll bring back a bit of a change of pace and focus for the discussion this morning. A lot of it will be kind of focused on China, but I hope that during the course of the presentation we'll be able to demonstrate the relevance of this sort of concern for the type of discussion and focus on non-traditional security issues and how that is going to play into the issues of how we deal with rising emerging powers. Let me make a blunt point to begin with, and that is Australia and Japan face one overriding security challenge as the Asian region's security order undergoes a fairly dramatic change, which we heard of earlier. And that is, how do we ensure maintaining a credible military posture along with our friends, and at the same time convincing China that this is not part of some sort of anti-China alliance bent on its containment? Or perhaps to put this in another way, our regional security policies, while accepting the inevitable uncertainties associated with China's growth in power and influence, should carefully be crafted to avoid setting in train the very outcomes that we want to avoid. As Richard Andrews mentioned earlier, the Australia and Japan security relationship is actually, in its more active form, is quite new. It's really over the last decade or so. Richard spoke at that very effectively. In fact, the Australia-Japan Joint Declaration on Security Cooperation in 2007 really marked, I think, something of a turning point. And it's interesting to note that when that was signed, there was certainly a lot of eyebrows raised around the region because the concerns of how this would be viewed by China, although I think it's important to note that those concerns seem to have been allayed and died down. Of course, the changes in the, as Richard pointed out, in the bilateral security relationship are a response to a changing security environment, the key element of which, of course, is the growing and influential China. And linked to this, the growing realization that the United States, while remaining the most powerful global military power for a considerable time, will be unable to maintain the strategic primacy, at least to the extent that it has, in the Asian region that it has had since 1945. And in the face of this, Japan and Australia have two quite different sets of concerns. One is that the US will diminish or even withdraw its security role in the region, or alternatively, at the other end of the spectrum, that the US will seek to maintain a dominant role, which might eventually lead to a military clash with China. And preventing either of these unpalatable outcomes has really, I think, driven Australian and Japanese foreign and security policies in the past decade. While Australia and Japan have very similar security interests and concerns in the Asian region, and particularly in respect of China, they're not identical. We've heard we both have alliances with the US, we both have very, very high levels of economic interdependence with China, but we have fundamental differences with the latter's political values and what people call hot economics and cold politics. And we both have some concerns at some point about having to choose between China and the US. But despite these similarities, the intensity of the similarities vary, and I think it's fair to say that Japan's relations with China are far more complex and sensitive than our Australia's. And I think the reasons for this are historical and obviously geographic proximity that Japan has to regional hotspots, territorial disputes, North Korea, Taiwan, and so on. Some observers have even argued that Japan would prefer to see a cool relationship between China and the US in the belief that this would keep the latter more closely aligned with Japan. Now, I don't know whether there's any substance to this. Some of our Japanese colleagues might comment on that. Whether or not it's true, it's certainly not the case with Australia. Australia most definitely wants good relations with both the US and China and has absolutely no fears that a deal between the two would somehow or other leave Australia more isolated. On the contrary. So both of us have had our post-war security underwritten by the US. We both see a growing acceptance of the limits and relevance of the US nuclear deterrent in North Asia and doubts that the US will be able to maintain the same level of strategic primacy. So in this environment, both of us have to develop our security policies in a very different framework. And it's also important to note that in this environment, the US itself is looking to its allies to do more to bolster their own and regional security. So I think it's fair to say that Australia and Japan's security relations are assuming a new significance, and I think the increased bilateral activity between us really should be seen in this context. So in responding to this new environment and the challenges, what can we do? What can the two countries do? And I think there's a mix of things that we can do bilaterally and also regionally. One immediate and obvious challenge for both countries is that of political will and resources. Obviously, if regional countries are to do more to bolster their own security and defence posture as part of a regional approach and in response to US requests, there are real questions over their economic and political capacity to do so. And both Australia and Japan have some very, very critical and difficult decisions to make in this regard. Japan's economic situation, the reconstruction after the March 11 disasters, I think are well known. Even in Australia, we've done reasonably well in the global financial crisis, but we still have serious budget deficit issues to deal with, and the costs of upgrading military hardware and so on are enormous. But I think even more important than the sort of budgetary and economic issues is the political and strategic challenges. And foremost among these is, as Australia and Japan develop their security policies with other regional countries, is how do we avoid actions that either explicitly or implicitly assume certain outcomes, in particular in respect of the ramifications of China's rise, that these somehow or other become preordained outcomes. And I think for many people in Japan and in Australia, and I dare say in other countries, this will require some important changes in mindset, perhaps moving away from the tendency to view China with rather dated politicized concepts. While China's political system and one-party state clearly falls short of the of what countries like Japan and Australia would like to see, there is in fact greater plurality in that country than we've seen before. And the sort of nationalistic and militaristic views we seen coming from various sources, retired PLA officers and the like, should not automatically be seen as reflecting the views of a single leadership group. I think China is far more complex than this, and there are differing views, and there is an important focus on domestic concerns, economic growth, social order, and so on. Undoubtedly, Chinese leaders also see China as wielding greater power and influence in the region, but this, I don't think, implies inevitable expansionist or militaristic ambitions, as some fear. But nonetheless, many in the West view this prospect with alarm. So I think it's important for countries like ours to understand that while we are legitimately concerned about the lack of transparency in China's military buildup, Chinese leaders often find it difficult to understand the motives and thinking behind our defence and security policies. And I think that's something that we need to bear in mind. The potential for misunderstandings and miscalculations works both ways. So I think to try and wrap that up and work that into why the emphasis on non-traditional security issues is important. I think we have a high level of economic interdependence. All of us can do harm to other countries and in return can suffer a significant harm to ourselves. The so-called economic balance of terror. Economic balance of terror is something that perhaps can be overstated in terms of its contribution to a benign security environment, but I think it is an important contributor. The other part is that we have a very, very well-established regional security apparatus already in place. And I think that despite the fact that there are shortcomings in this, I think it's really through... So I think what I would like to finish up by saying is that it's the sort of discussion that we've had on the non-traditional security issues and the sorts of things that we were discussing yesterday in the workshop, these are the sorts of things that will hopefully de-stress or limit the focus on the security aspects of our relation, to move security to a much broader definition. And I think there's much work that can be done there. I think Australia and Japan are extremely well placed to develop those things jointly and with our regional partners. So I think I'll end it there. Thank you.
Colin, thank you very much, both for the content and for adhering to time. That actually is very helpful. We now have a 5-minute break, and I do have to say it is a 5-minute break, and we'll resume afterwards with the second session. Thank you very much.